the Get Hipcast episode 4. It's personal. My guests this week are the lovely Brooke Scanlon. Brooke, say hello.
Hello.
Paige Wagner, say hello, Paige.
Hi.
And our resident outsider, Adam DeVito. We thought we'd change it up this week. Say hello, Adam.
How are you? How's everybody?
All right. So for those of you who've listened to the Get Hipcast before, it's kind of a play on words where we talk about and explore the intersection of technology and culture. We're at a time where there's a fairly significant culture shift going on, and there's no doubt that things have changed a lot in how we work and our level of transparency, how intentional we have to be and how we communicate and behave. And the goal here is to kind of explore some of the things in previous episodes we've explored, you know, the intersection of technology more. This week, what we want to talk about is personal relationships and how personal relationships have changed. So I thought it'd be great to introduce my guests, tell you a little bit about them, and then I'll ask them to tell you a little bit about themselves. So first we have Paige Wagner. Paige is a project manager extraordinaire on my team. She recently received her PMP. Golf clap. We got to welcome Paige to our team from another line of business within our organization. I can't really remember how Paige landed on the team, but hopefully she'll give us a little insight to that. And if she doesn't, I'll ask her questions, which will force her to give us some insight. But undoubtedly, it was our great gain, someone else's great loss. Next, we have Brooke Scanlon. And Brooke is another extraordinary project manager who is planning her PMP shortly. And since she is the fourth in line, I'm sure the pressure is mounting. Brooke, again, we inherited from another area of the business. And everyone hears that saying, I'd rather be lucky than good. And in the case of Paige and Brooke, I definitely got lucky. My parents have this saying, tell me who you go with and I'll tell you who you are. So I think without Paige, we probably wouldn't have Brooke. So we're going to kind of explore their personal relationship. Paige kind of jumped into the water, didn't know what existed there. And then she dragged her friend along with her. So I'll be interested to hear how that's worked out. And then my last guest is Adam DeVito. And Adam is an outsider, but someone who I respect immensely because he's a sales guy. And that's hard to come by as a sales guy. But he's a detail-oriented guy, always thinking about how to innovate something new. And I recollect sitting in Koreatown with Adam like 10 years ago. And Adam was just giving me all the ideas he had come up with in like the last 20 years and how he was going to make millions and how we could do it together. It was a great, great lunch. I think, you know, I've known Adam now probably for 11 or 12 years. We have a good professional relationship, but I think it's personal because we have good cultural fit and we get along well. And a big, big component of culture is how you interact with someone personally. So I thought it'd be great to invite Adam and kind of get his take on it as an outsider and someone who really I've developed a personal relationship with through professional interaction. So I think this will be an interesting episode. And now that I've kind of talked a little about everyone, we'll get them to introduce themselves. So Paige, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself, background, et cetera.
Sure. I'm Paige Wagner. I've been a project manager with this company for 4 years now. Some of you already know, but I was before this working as a counselor with kids with severe behavioral issues. One of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life thus far. And actually, Brooke saved me from that. She is the one who got me a job with this company as a project manager. So that really helped me out. And as far as coming to the team that I'm at now, it's funny. I think Randy had called my manager at the time and said, hey, we need help. We need a PM over here. And the manager came to me and was like, hey, you'd be a good fit for this. Like, I think you should come, you know, go over to this team. And I'm, you know, scared to do it because it's change. And I've never really had like a sense sense of belonging where I was at. Like, I've just, I've always changed teams, so I was a little bit reluctant to do so. But after talking with Randy on a couple occasions, she was like, you're going to love it. It's a huge learning curve, but you're going to do great. And of course, it was the best decision that I made, you know, thus far. So I'm really happy to be here.
Thanks, Paige. How about you, Brooke?
My name's Brooke Scanlon. I started with Fusion Storm in 2014 as I think my title was administrative assistant, which isn't even a real title here, but it was my first entry-level job, so it was awesome. Before that, I worked at a bar, so, you know, things started looking up. And, yeah, I found myself coming over to Expert Services after, 5.5 years or so over on a different team. And the reason for it was my current team, there was so much change. I don't know, I was looking for a change too. And so Paige, obviously we talk, and she really talked up Expert Services. And I thought I would give it a try. And super happy that I did, super happy that I was given the opportunity to come over, and I'm here, and it's been awesome.
All right, thanks, Paige. All right, Adam, how about you?
Sure. I mean, from the sound.
I mean, thanks, Brooke. Thanks, Brooke. You guys. You know what? I'm watching, like, I'm watching the chat as I'm chastising, and Paige is responding. Thanks, Brooke. Go ahead, Adam.
No, I think from the sound of it, the talk, Rich, at some point in my career, I think I need to work for you, because it just sounds like that's, you know, everyone super happy working for you. But thanks for inviting me on. So I'm Adam DeVito. I think Rich is right. I've known him about, it's got to be, 12 years or so now. I am, let's see, where do I start? I'm a father of four kids. I've been married about 14 years. I have been a technologist probably. Well, I've been in technology, call it probably close to 20 now. And pretty much anything with a microchip or a motor in it is kind of my interest when I do have free time, which obviously with four kids, I don't get as much of as I used to. But I've been following along on this series of podcasts. I love the concept of finding these interesting kind of intersections as people pivot here. And so was very appreciative of the invite to join in, Rich. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for being here. All right. So we're going to start with a question to kind of break the ice. And I have a special background for this question, so I'm just going to fire that up real quick. okay. So the question we're going to start with is, do you own or have you ever thought of buying a set of Giza sheets? We will start with you, Paige. And if you don't know what Giza sheets are or who that guy is, you can just say, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay. Brooke, how about you?
No, I've seen this guy before, and I've thought about his product before, but I thought it was a pillow, so.
Well, he's making sheets now too.
Oh, but okay.
do you own them? Have you thought about buying a MyPillow?
I thought about it.
Okay, all right. DeVito, come on, we know you own the sheets and the towels.
So I'll tell you this much, I don't have the sheets, but if you hunt around my house, you probably will find multiple pillows. There's probably no question about that.
Okay, all right, well, that's good. We've all given some insight to our political affiliation in the most roundabout way possible. And we'll dig into the questions now. Okay. All right. Paige and Brooke, you're both good friends. You both went to the same institution for higher education. I believe you were dorm mates. I know that through listening to dinner conversations. Your friendship gave way, to an opportunity for our team to that to not only benefit from having you on our team, but where you trusted our culture enough, Paige, to drag along your friend into our culture. So my questions are, how'd you get here, which you already kind of told us about? How is this culture and operating environment different than the environment that you were in before? And it's great that we have something. It's great that we have something that's worthy of your stamp of approval that you would bring along your friend. But the question is, what is that something? So there's really two questions, right? How's this culture different than the other cultures? Obviously not the one you worked in where you were constantly troubled children. And I'm sure this is less stressful. But different than the other technology areas you've worked in. And then what is that thing that made it like, hey, I gotta grab my best friend and get her to come work in this environment too?
So I think first of all, her coming over, I think that just comes down to trust. We've known each other for so long. She trusted me enough to make this move. I had talked about it for so long with her. And as far as the culture goes, I think Brooke can agree with me that where we were at before with that team, we had moved around so much. There were so many, I think the 3 years I was over there, I had four managers. There was just no sense of belonging. And I felt that right when I came over to the team I'm at now, because I think everyone, or if not everyone, the majority of people have been with you for, years. And it was kind of like, in a way, it was kind of like a family, and with that comes trust and support. And one of the other things that I saw too was confidence. I noticed that a lot of people had confidence on the team, and that was kind of something that I lacked in some ways, especially when speaking out in groups. That's just something that I never really did. So that was a big thing for me, and also just challenging each other. I mean, I knew I would grow as a project manager when I came over, and I just wanted to share that with Brooke, because I think we were both in the same situation where we just moved around so much. We never had one team to be a part of.
And Brooke, did Paige oversell you at all? Or would she tell you the exact truth?
No, I would say she told me the exact truth. And, when her and I were discussing it, there was a point where I was a little bit on the fence because my prior team had, they were still in kind of a forming phase for sure, which is actually kind of normal over there because there was so much change, as Paige said. And I, had been there for so long that I thought, well, maybe I should stay and stick it out and maybe there's opportunity in that. And then I spoke with another former colleague who, getting her advice, and she was like, do it. So, I don't think that she oversold it. I think it's just a night and day difference. And I'm super thankful that I was able to make that move.
Cool. Okay. All right, next question. So, Adam, we've known each other for 10, 11, 12 years, whatever it is. We've always, but I feel like no matter what deals we worked, some of them were super complex with hedge funds that should remain unnamed. Some of them, but no matter what deal we were in, no matter how stressful they were, how big they were, I feel like we always had fun and got creative on how we, we would try to drive them forward. My question is, like, how do you view, like, the magic sauce of alignment or fit professionally? And how does that, like, professional relationship transcend into something that's more intimate and personal, right? Because I'm sure, like, for me, I know it's especially hard given what we're doing right now. Everything's virtual, right? It's super easy, and we've talked about this on previous podcasts, super easy to interact with people you already had a relationship with, right? Yep. You you get on a WebEx, right? It's like, man, I don't know why I wasn't doing this all along. Like, yeah, but you've already established a personal, some sort of personal relationship. How deep or shallow it is can be debated. But now here we are, and we're trying to establish relationships with people we've never met before, virtually. And is that even possible? Doing what we're doing now, and how has it changed? Like, so I guess what I'm looking for is, like, what do you feel like over the relationship that you and I have, or that you have with other folks that was developed professionally? Like, how does that happen? Like, is it just execution? Is it, what is like the magic bullet, or is it so many things that kind of come together that just make it the right fit that you can't put your finger on it?
So interesting. I don't know. I'm thinking back. Certainly, it's funny. You brought up the lunch we had, I was on a tear back then, whatever I was thinking about, done ideas. You know what I remember is, didn't you drag me to a Megadeth concert one time? I think it was,
It was Iron Maiden, but
sorry, okay. Iron Maiden, right. So, I think to that point, there is an important aspect to being able to interact with people face to face, right? And there's no doubt that's certainly being challenged right now. I think to go back to the first part of the question, right? I don't know if it's necessarily magic, but I think what happens is you tend to, you tend to have connections with people that are kind of rooted in certain commonalities, right? And so I found over the years through, hundreds, if not thousands of relationships, you have relationships that, just kind of continue to be professional relationships versus relationships you have that go deeper. And I think the common thread there is the fact that with those relationships, there tends to be, one, I think a bit of a mutual respect, but I think more importantly is there's an alignment of just interests that go beyond just whatever the business outcome is, right, that you're looking to drive. And so, whether it be kind of common interests or even common ethics, I think that tends to then drive kind of a deeper connection where you start to connect on other levels. And that's not to say like there's anything wrong with professional relationships. We all have them, right? And I think to some extent, they serve a bit of a different purpose. And I think people know that, right? And so both parties are kind of okay with that. It's kind of a more outcome-driven relationship. But, as it relates to you and I think early on, right, one of the things is, to your point around deal complexity or, kind of regardless of some of the deals we may have worked on, I think there was always an angle there that there was a common interest outside of just trying to drive the outcome of the deal, right? Whether, I know for me, it was always the fact like you'd always, challenge or offer up an alternative perspective, right? So I think you tend to connect with people on kind of threads that lie outside of just of that outcome that you're trying to drive.
It's good feedback. Okay, so follow-up question. This is kind of for all three and you, no particular order. Whoever wants to talk first can tend, or I'll just pick someone. But and there's a long question. So the first part of it is, for trust to exist, does the relationship actually have to move from a purely professional relationship to contain some personal aspect? Like, can you establish trust in a purely professional relationship? Or does it have to move to some, does there have to be some personal hook to it? And why or why not? Like, support your position. Paige, we'll start with you.
I think it's helpful, if it does, but it doesn't always work that way, unfortunately. I mean, I try to get a personal connection with clients. Like, I feel it just makes everything more enjoyable and comfortable if you do. I think the 50-50% that you mentioned can go higher if you try harder to connect. I mean, I love having personal connections with people. That's just something that, I have learned to do, especially working from home, because I've always worked from home. And like, I think it does have to go a little bit more. Like, I think about Randy, you know, my manager, like Randy, Brooke and I have a text group, you know, that we, so we talk outside of work, like we make it a little bit more personal. I think that's really important to build the trust there, in my opinion.
How about you, Brooke?
I kind of want to agree and disagree with Paige. In a professional setting, I don't necessarily need a personal connection to be able to trust somebody because it's in a professional setting. Like, we're here to do a job. This is your one job. You should do it. And I should be able to trust you to do that. But like Paige said, having a personal connection does really help. And especially, you know, with customers, if you, or, well, not just customers, your teammates too. If you are a personable person and you're nice and, you know, you're there for your team, they want to work with you and they want to, you know, live up to their duties for you. And that's, you know, part of leadership too. So does it help? Yeah. Do I expect to be able to trust you at work because that's your job? Yeah.
Good feedback. How about you, DeVito?
Yeah, I'll probably have a little more of a sales guy spin on this, but at the end of the day, to me, when you use the word trust, you automatically identify there's a personal connection, right? Because I believe to establish trust, whether it's a colleague, a teammate, a customer, there has to be some level of personal connection. Outside of that, in a purely professional connection, the same concept is called leverage, right? So I look at it as, in the professional setting, if there's no trust established and it's merely for the transaction of business, both sides are really counting on leverage to kind of drive behavior. And the second trust comes into it, you know, that to me signifies there is a personal connection. And ultimately, we all want that, right? Even in our professional relationships, you want to have some aspect of trust, because it means you go beyond just looking at that person or that particular team in kind of a transactional way. But I kind of have a bit more of a hard line between those two terms for sure.
Yeah, I think all I think fair points and outlooks. And I think the what's interesting is the word trust is perceived by different people in different ways. And I think it's what makes it kind of dangerous, right? Like, I think, Brooke, you trust that if you have a job, regardless of whether we have a personal relationship or not, you trust that that person's going to do their job. In a perfect world, that would be awesome. We don't live in a perfect world. And there are plenty of people who won't do their job, and you will get burnt because you trusted that that was the norm, right? The norm is you show up, you get paid to do a job, you do it. Life would be easy if we could take things at that level of face value, right? For me, I feel like I do a better job when I'm trusted and not leveraged. And largely because I feel like it's an equitable relationship. Like, where we're looking to win together. And no one's looking to come out on top, whether it's a customer, a peer, whoever. When it becomes somebody's, it has to be a winner and a loser. To me, it's hard to establish trust. Like, I don't trust the car buying experience because I know I'm a loser. Even if I felt like I won, I know somehow that car dealer made money. They told me that they're selling it to me at less than invoice, but I know it's not true. So we're already at a place where we can't establish trust because you lied to me, because that's not what the car cost you, because I know you'd be out of business. So I'm in a much better place if you said to me, this is a $50,000 car and I'm making $1,000 and I work on volume. I'd be like, awesome. Thanks for being transparent with me. Like, everybody's got to make money in the process. I just feel like that trust thing, even professionally, is something that gets exposed, I think, pretty quickly. Like, you tend to either trust people or not trust them pretty quickly, even if it is professional or personal. That's my take. Okay, so because of the pandemic, we've been doing things virtually, and we talked a little bit about how it's hard to get personal connection, especially when you're connecting with someone for the first time. Is it harder to build trust virtually? Or to go back to Brooke's point, is because we're operating virtually, we have this like pure metric of execution. Like if you meet someone for the first time and you commit to doing something on a Zoom or a WebEx or a Skype, like do you establish trust just by the mere fact, untainted by anything else? Like you like to go to the same bars, you like the same sports teams, like all these things that we talk about personally. Those things are sort of void in the virtual world. So is it easier to establish a trust relationship purely based on execution? DeVito, we'll start with you.
So it's an interesting question. I would certainly say the pandemic has done a couple of interesting things. And again, this will obviously be from a very sales-driven perspective, but I have to think about from a trust standpoint, because I think you're right. What happens is you pull a lot of those other factors out of the equation. You can still establish trust through a virtual interface, right? What becomes really hard is influence, right? What I find the hardest thing for us to do kind of in this, this move to an all virtual world is kind of influence, customers, influence outcome, influence partners. You know, these are things I think did happen through, face-to-face interaction, time spent together, finding commonality and things like this. And so, it's interesting. I would say maybe it takes longer to establish some of the trust, or I'll go back to my point before where maybe we're spending less time trying to build those trusted personal relationships and more time just focused on kind of more professional and transactional relationships. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think it'll take a little time to kind of prove out in this model what impact that's actually had, especially for those who spend their days like in a selling motion. You know what I mean?
Is the removal, I'm going to tease this out a little bit because it's an interesting topic. Is the removal of influence a bad thing? And I'll provide an example. You show up every day, you're better. You know your execution is better. You know your product is better. Your people are better. But you've been unable to win or even get a seat at the table because someone has had influence because of a personal relationship, not based on the ability to execute. Are we trying to establish, I guess, as technology people, are we trying to establish influence, or are we missing the idea that we can't create influence right now, and that we're moving more to an execution-based relationship? Where is that, like, is that a bad, I guess, is it a bad thing that we can't unfairly influence things through personal relationship? Like, because that's what we're basically saying. I want to unfairly influence things because I have a, is that a bad thing?
So I'll call you out for using the word unfairly, right? So you're putting a negative connotation on influence as part of the selling cycle. So, I think what happens is, and you can appreciate this as technologists in an IT world, we tend to think or conclude that if we position our product or offering logically, then the best solution or the best technology should ultimately win. But as we know, a lot of times, and there's proof of this everywhere you look, are there companies and organizations that went out who always don't necessarily have the best technology or the best team. And I think that's part of, I mean, that gets into this bigger discussion, I think, about free market dynamics and all these other concepts that kind of come into play when you create a market. So, you know, that said, I go back to the word influence, because I don't necessarily look at influence as an unfair advantage or as a negative thing as part of the sales cycle. A lot of times influence can be positive, and people do buy based on influence in a relationship. I'll go back to your car example. I mean, you know, I tend to buy the same brand of vehicle over and over again because I go back to the same guy, wherever he might have moved over the past years, to buy a car, because I trust in that experience and that engagement I had with him, to your point, whether it was transparency or he established personal trust. So, you know, that may mean I may drive, you know, whatever, domestic car for a lot of years, or then I may be moving over to a foreign car, because to me, it's more about the experience. The vehicle is almost a commodity, so to speak, in the sense of the outcome it provides. Now, I'm not trying to say technology is commoditized, or those segments are, but I don't think you can totally remove influence from any sales process, because at the end of the day, that relationship piece is still a key part to why people buy, in my opinion, anyway.
Well, you buy from that guy because you trust him.
Personally. Yeah, you could say that, right? You buy because there's a personal connection there. So you go back there to do that.
Yep. I wasn't indicating that influence was fair or unfair. I was only trying to get us back to the trust conversation. Yeah. And the fact that I think people do make things more personal than they necessarily want to admit. Like, for me, I have the exact opposite car experience. I buy from the same dealership. The car, the person selling me the car, is less relevant to me. The dealership is relevant because it's really like the ownership of the dealer creates an ecosystem that will survive forever.
Correct.
In my mind. So,
and you're probably valuing it based on the product. You're looking at the differences in the tech or the product, where I'm probably more commoditizing the things you evaluate when you look at a vehicle, for that being the example we're using.
Yeah, I think I look at it more in the service experience. And I feel like one person has a tough time of influencing the full experience of like what you're going to get out of service. So for me, the car is insignificant. It's like the service experience I'm going to get. Like, when I drop my car off, I don't want to wait there. I want a loaner. Like, these are like things that are important to me. The car isn't that important. I know the car is going to break down, right? Same thing in tech. Like, I know the tech's going to break. It's like, what's going to happen when it breaks? And I think there is a piece of it that says, yeah, a person, a relationship with a person can totally change your experience. Like, we've lived that, right? Like, who you know and who you can call can totally change your service experience. Like, the organization has the capabilities, but how fast you can navigate through those capabilities, that's meaningful, right? In your case, I think you're saying this person you trust has always proven to you that they can take care of you. So you placed your trust in that person. And for me, in the car example, I place my trust. The dealer has proved to me that regardless of who I interact with there, it's always a great experience. So I feel like it kind of comes from the top down, and it's the kind of the ownership's job to make sure that experience is ubiquitous.
Makes sense.
Just different perspectives.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this was the original question, but going back to, you know, now that we are virtual and don't have, or we have a harder time making those personal connections, I feel that right now a lot of trust is coming from our execution. And I think in like personal influences, I mean, I would not be on this team if it wasn't from my personal influence from Paige, and I trusted her to come here. I don't, you know, what if this team was terrible and Paige just wanted somebody to text with all day because she's bored? I mean, that would stink, but I trusted her through our personal relationship to bring me to a, you know, a beneficial place, and she did. So I think it is making our jobs harder now that we're virtual, that it is just, you know, did we get the job done? Cool. I can probably trust you. Not, I know you and I think that you'll put me in a good place.
Yeah. And you're talking with them in person, like, oh, we're going to get this done. You know, virtually, I think execution is so important because you don't get to have those face-to-face conversations. So it's just like, if you execute the work, you're good to go. I think for, and Brooke can probably agree with me on this, like with the pandemic and working virtually, I mean, I didn't really skip a beat personally because I've always worked from home. So it was business as usual. So I've already learned to make those personal connections virtually because it's just something that I've had to do the past 4 years that I've been working here. So I think for people who worked in the office, I'm sure that was a very, very difficult transition for them. Like, I can't even imagine, but you know, as far as it goes for me, I mean, I always work from home. So,
I mean, yeah, I'm torn. Like, to me, in some ways I like I have a couple different perspectives, right? It's been 6-7 months, right? We've been doing this. Like, I could say, yeah, it's a lot harder because, you know, people we interacted with, they're different. They've been different over the last 7 months in this execution model than they were 8 months ago when we would see them face to face. But the reality is I haven't seen that. Like, I've seen that the people were the same 8 months ago virtually as they are, like, because it's personal. And some people are just that way. Like, some people, they want an ounce of blood every day of the week. And they expect flawless execution. And we all know that's impossible. Like, no one can execute flawlessly forever. Like, you're going to fail. Like, it's going to happen. Like, if I tell you anything different, I'm lying. So, to me, it's like the people you have great relationships with are the people who realize eventually you'll fail. Eventually, you'll miss a text and you won't call them back. And they could cut you off or they could, you know, not, they could, you could call them and instead of, like, talking about something meaningful, they could ask you for an hour and a half why you didn't call them back. Like, those are just, there are just people like that. And then there are people who, like, move past, like, the silly stuff because what happened yesterday doesn't really matter. It's kind of like what you're doing today to fix it. So let's talk about that. And I think the example that I've always used is, like, you don't have, like, an assigned person to recover a fumble. Like, it's not a job on a football field. It's like a cultural thing. You know, if you play football and somebody drops the ball, 22 people try to recover the football. And all the people standing on the sidelines want to run on the field to recover the football. And all the people in the stands want to jump on the field and recover, because it's the nature of seeing a football rolling around a football field that says, grab the ball. And it's not like, you know, nobody spends time going, you know, chastising the running back as to why he dropped it, or telling the free safety it's their job to get the ball. Like, it just doesn't work that way. But there are a lot of people who would rather spend time on the topic of, like, who dropped the ball than let's pick the ball up. So I do think there's, like, there's a piece of it that's super personal. And there is a, to me, it's like, I think there is a cultural fit where sometimes you just gel with people and sometimes you don't. And when you don't and you fail, it's kind of game over. So I'm always, like, thinking about, do I tread water, like, trying to execute flawlessly forever? Because I know I won't be able to do it. So, like, am I wasting our collective time by creating this facade? DeVito, you got a response. I can see you chomping at the bit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I love the perspective, but I think underlying that, like, assumes, and great. I mean, if you're in a position where you have the luxury to pick and choose to only work with people that you connect with on a personal level, I think that's a great place in life, right? I mean, if you can do that and be selective about the business, only work with those people that alignment. I think generally speaking, part of why you don't establish personal relationships with everybody is just that. It maintains it at a professional level. And that's where leverage comes in, right? Because at the end of the day, if you've got a good service, solution, technology, whatever that you're delivering that delivers some outcome from the business, what keeps everybody in the guardrails is the fact that there needs to be some mutual leverage or bi-directional leverage. Because if there's not, you're right, then you don't really have a healthy business relationship to one side or the other, because you've got one party that, you know, has a skewed outcome, right? So
let's reframe the word personal for a minute into cultural fit. Maybe it doesn't need to be personal, but it needs to be cultural, because when there's a cultural fit, which means there's some underlying alignment or commonality, some thread that you can latch onto that says you're culturally aligned, right? And I think if we look at like social unrest in the world today, people have aligned pretty quickly over what are fundamentally cultural commonality. Like, there are cultural commonalities that have caused people who don't know each other at all. Never met each other, like, don't know what, but all of a sudden, they're fully aligned on really important things. And it's because of maybe a geographical region that they live in, maybe a the fact that manufacturing left the region, you know, and millions of other more complex topics. But I think it doesn't always have, like, if you have cultural alignment, the idea of more acceptance or connecting personally, it can be a professional relationship, but it can feel more intimate. Like, it doesn't have to be a personal relationship. It can be an intimate professional relationship because you kind of have the same philosophy. Yeah. And you don't have to have a personal relationship to understand what someone's philosophy is. Some people have a philosophy that, like, I want to blame other people. And some people have a philosophy that, like, I'm not really interested in blaming anyone. I'm more interested in fixing the problem. Yeah. And, like, those things, I think, are things that more so than are, like, we having dinner together on the weekends. Those are the things that I would call, like, the bridge from professional relationships to personal relationships, because it gives you that thing where now you can have a dialogue that transcends like the project you're working on or the sales opportunity, because you have other things to talk about.
Yep. Yeah. I think it kind of goes back to, you know, I think your earlier question, right? Like, what's that magic, component. And I'm not, like I said, I don't think it's really magic, right? I think it's finding that kind of mutual interest, whether it be around ethics or whatever, that kind of lies outside of just the business outcome, right? That ultimately, I think, is what drives people to want to form and create more personal type of relationships. So. Yeah.
All right. Well, Brooke, how important do you think tech has been during the last, 6 or 7 months in terms of maintaining relationships, forging new relationships? What role has technology played for you, both personally and professionally?
I mean, it's been everything. You know, my job really hasn't changed, other than I might even be a little bit more busy because people are relying on technology more. Being forced to stay home, I think in my area, there was a handful of months where, you couldn't even go out to a restaurant. You could go to the grocery store and that was about it. And it was driving us crazy. And I think about, being a little kid when I didn't have a cell phone or maybe we didn't have Wi-Fi. What was I doing, Probably playing, doing little kid things. But now, to be able to call my parents, FaceTime my parents, to work from home, still have a job because I can work from home and I have technology. It's everything.
How about you, Paige?
Yeah, it could be all a business has, like ours, where, IT, where technology, it is everything. I agree with Brooke 100%. It's the reason why I'm able to work remotely is through technology, which, again, I always have. But with this pandemic, for, people who were in office, we're able to keep our jobs because we can do our jobs through technology. And on a personal level, I moved across country, so technology is the only way that I maintain relationships with my family and friends, you know, back in Oregon. Without that, I would lose all communication. I would have no idea what they're doing. So that's like, on a personal level, it's really important to me as well.
David, I'll ask you a little different, like, because you're probably having more first-time conversations via technology than probably the rest of us on this call. But so what's it like for you in terms of, you know, the role tech's playing for, like, you know, personal family stuff and yeah, you know, kind of maintaining professional relationships, but then also what's it like trying to conduct, you know, sales and first time meetings where you've never met the people before, like repeatedly? Like I do a few of them here and there, but probably nowhere near the volume that you do. So what is that like?
Yeah. So I'll break it up, right? Cause on the personal side, for a guy who, you know, has generally been a lover of technology, it's, you know, with four kids at home trying to homeschool, it's actually become quite a burden. I probably need to hire you guys to do like IT operations with all the network stuff and everything else that has to go on. So, you know, that said, you know, I think it's an interesting debate because, you know, I look at my kids and, you know, the first class I was ever able to take virtually over a laptop, you know, I was already in college by the time they even had that remotely working. And I'll still call it experimental because you still had to attend class and you were maybe doing some assignments. You know, my third grader is literally consuming content 100% remote. Now, you know, we can argue, we won't really know what the outcome of this learning experience is for a few years and whether they missed something, but just the fact that they were able to spin and implement that, I think, in a short period of time is just a testament to the fact of how far we've kind of come. So, you know, from that standpoint in just kind of my personal life, I think it's really cool to kind of see that happen, right? Professionally, I think it's a double-edged sword. So, you know, in this new role I'm in, right? I mean, I have responsibility to grow out this team. And so this is the first time in my career where I've had to hire people and train people without being able to meet them. And that in and of itself has been like a very interesting experience. There are some good sides to it. I mean, and I think it was Brooke who mentioned it before, or it might've been Paige, that, you know, being able to connect with people, in fact, maybe even being more busy. I think there's a efficiency you almost gain when you're trying to manage across a region. I find I actually am able to talk to or interface with more people on a daily basis than when I used to have to travel in and out of region, let's say, or do something like that. Now, are the interactions as meaningful? I'm not sure. Are you building the same level or depth of relationship? You can question all that stuff. But there's no doubt in my mind, like, you know, I think the fact that the economy, you know, the economy only contracted 48% and not like 87% is a mere testament to the fact that the technology exists to do that. If we didn't have those capabilities, forget the fact of us talking about, you know, recessions or depressions, right? I think we would have seen a much different kind of impact on our overall economy. In terms of, you know, first calls and using the tool that way, it's difficult. I mean, you know, the reality is I think it is harder. You know, our inside sales team spend a ton of time churning and burning through, you know, leads and potential clients or potential contacts trying to land and get commitment for attendance to these virtual meetings. I think there's less commitment on people's behalf to attend, right? So when I used to schedule a meeting and show up, and I mean, you know, you remember these days, I'd bring lunch or donuts or whatever it was. It was a lot harder when someone didn't show up to look you in the eye and be like, hey, dude, sorry I stood you up. At least they had to come up with a better excuse. Hey, the network was down. I had an outage. We had a, you know, Sev1. Sorry, I can't make the meeting. You know, when I just spent $5,000 to fly halfway across the country or whatever it is. Now, you know, we're able to connect with a lot of people, but we get a lot of what I would call non-well-intended engagements. We'll get people who jump on for a free hat. We'll get people who will jump on because they want a break from whatever's going on with their kids. But I don't know how engaged or committed they are to really trying to get something out of that meeting. So I think there's still some work there to try to kind of figure out what the tools are and how effective or what's more effective as a tool to do that.
That's a great point. I haven't really thought about the quid pro quo that was created when you showed up for a meeting and the customer canceled on you when you're in the lobby, right? Yeah. It's like, there is a piece of like feeling bad.
It's called leverage.
Now there's like, the amount of effort is so little to get on a Zoom call. Right. That like, if someone cancels on you, like, they're like, yeah, I mean, come on, you were sitting at home. Like, what's the big deal, right?
But like, do you feel like customers are canceling more just because we're all working remotely now?
So I think what's happening, and likewise, I can relate, I think customers have a lot of other things pulling at them, right? I mean, I think early on in this pandemic, right, everyone was trying to adjust to life at home and kids at home and what's happening at work and, you know, how do we spin up remote access for all these employees? So I think people's priorities changed as they tried to adjust. Mm-hmm. But I do think for a lot of people who didn't work at home full time normally, it's an adjustment. And there's no doubt. I mean, I'm a guy, you know, I mean, I spend probably, you know, prior to March of this year, right, I was on the road on average like 3 days a week, right? It took my family a month just to get used to the fact that I was home every day. And me, likewise, to get used to the fact that there were all these other things pulling at me from, you know, even when you had work to be done. So I actually find, especially the guys on my team or the gals on my team who have worked from home or have roles that allow them to work from home, you're right. They're way more productive. They're way better at time management than I ever was, because I had, you know, I left my house and I came back to my house. And those worlds were somewhat compartmentalized. So if there was something going on, I wasn't distracted by the mailman or the lawn guys or whatever was going on, or there's an issue with the, you know, whatever, something's broken. You know, those things, I think it takes an adjustment for people to get used to. And so it's very hard because they do pull. I think they pull from people's attention. And I've had it. I've had a guy get on a call and, hey, I have to jump. My kid's having a meltdown, right? I got to go address that or something. And that's understandable, right? I mean, people have lives, right? I mean, that's ultimately why we all do this. But I think on the front side of the business, it's another obstacle, right? That you have to figure out how to get creative, how to create something somebody wants to invest the time into, right?
Sorry, Rich.
No, go ahead, Paige.
I was going to say, you can think of it as from the other side too, like working remotely all the time and then, you know, going into the office a couple of times a year, like that's distracting to me, you know, because I'm so used to being at home. I've had a routine. When I go into the office, I have all of like, you know, my coworkers and, you know, managers there. Like I want to chat. I think it's just wherever you feel most comfortable. And when you kind of do something different, the distractions come up, you know, so it's interesting to think about.
I think we talked about this either last week or the week before. Like I really think this, you know, listen, a lot of companies, if they weren't forced to like send everyone home and have them work from home, they would have never done it. Like they may have never gotten there. So I think some people who left their house every morning and kind of compartmentalized their work day, yeah, they struggled, but I think most people have found some efficiencies in working from home, and I think people will get better about not having a work from, you know, an office culture or work from home culture, but more a performance and focus culture where people are really more empowered to say, hey, listen, if you're going to be on calls from 6 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, cause you have the West, like you don't really want to commute 2 hours in the morning, add 2 hours of a commute in the morning, 2 hours of commute in the afternoon. So you can go sit in an office and be hostile all day. Like that's not a good use of time. So I know from experience, a lot of times people say, listen, we're trying to bridge the gap between this work from home and working off. So we're going to mandate like these 2 days of week are going to be office days. That doesn't work for everyone. Some people have to work at night on that Tuesday, and like being in the office all day on Tuesday just doesn't work with what they do for a living. So I think we will learn a lot coming out of this around just how to enable people to better manage their own personal schedules. And people have been locked in their house for 7 months with zero human interaction will go, hey, maybe I'll show up at the office, but I'll show up for me because there's value to doing it, right? There's value to getting these 20 people in a room, because in 2 hours I can get a lot more accomplished than what I'd get accomplished on a WebEx, which I'd get exhausted by, you know, after sitting on a WebEx for 8 hours is exhausting. So sometimes it's better to get people in a room. So I think we'll get there. Brooke and Paige, this question is more for you because we're all on the same team and we've been trying to do stuff to, I kind of feel like you guys are remote, right? So kind of work by yourselves. You live in geographies that are nowhere near really an office. I mean, Brooke, you have an office, but I'm not sure anyone actually goes there. So, and you work for a team where the nucleus of the team was built in a city. And a lot of those people, like, it was built around an office culture initially. As we started to scale the team, we hired people in different geographies and, like, didn't really care about coming to the office anymore because a lot of our customers weren't coming to an office. Their office used to be their data center. They moved to a colo. They're working from home. Like, so we don't know where the customer is. And it just made sense for us to grow the team that way. But the reality is sometimes on a Tuesday, you know, you get eight people to go out to a happy hour and there's just no way for Brooke and Paige to come to the happy hour because they're hundreds of miles away, in some cases, thousands of miles away. So my question is, over this past 6 months, has it felt like you're more part of the team because we've done more things virtually together? Like, does it feel like things are more equal because no one's happy an hour in it, like on Tuesday night? Like, what's your perspective there? I know I've learned a lot more about I've learned a lot more about you guys in 6 months than I did in the prior time before that.
And yeah.
You're not alone.
So jealous when you guys, like, go out to your happy hours and stuff. Like, I'm sure Brooke would agree, we would totally love to be there. Like, that sucks. So the fact that you do, you know, the Zoom happy hours, like, that really helps. And I think it has made us all closer. Like, I feel like I have gotten closer to people because we are doing these, you know, video calls, you know, in the evening. And really just, it's not even about work. It's just about what we're doing. But yeah. I mean, that's what I think. It is that kind of factor that sucks that we just cannot go to anything in person. So the fact that no one can go in person, definitely, you know,
Right. Yeah, it's been nice because it's, you know, those real happy hours when you're talking about literally anything besides work, that's when I think you really make those connections. At least for me, I don't want to get off my work day and then go out to a bar and talk about a customer. I want to talk about, you know, your life and, like, people and that kind of stuff. So these virtual happy hours, you know, maybe we're playing a stupid game or I'm showing you what my cat looks like or whatever. It's been nice. And I definitely think it's brought the team together.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, DeVito, question for you, because we talked about all the good tech has done during this pandemic and quarantine and whatever else. But I struggle to, like, go on Facebook anymore, or, like, people just have infinite amount of time to post stuff that, like, they should really kind of keep to themselves. and I feel like, and then the level of emotional contagion that takes place, and it just starts, like, snowballing, you know, and then it's like, now it's just nasty. So, like, I feel like there's certain aspects of my life, like, I've always been a believer in video conferencing. You know, I've always loved Slack, you know, these are, like, I always loved these forums where you can communicate with people faster and quicker, and rather than picking the phone up and having a long dialogue, right? Like, I struggle when someone sends me an email that has, like, a spreadsheet of numbers in it. And then the last part of the email says, I'm calling you. Like, I don't know, it's a spreadsheet. Like, I can't determine, like, if you're calling me to give me your version of what I'm looking at, and I should be able to just look at it and kind of figure it out. But the social media scene, like, what's going on there?
Yeah, I'm probably, I don't know if you picked me to ask me this question on purpose or what, but, you know, I don't know, dude, the best way I can equate it is I feel like Facebook, and by the way, like LinkedIn and other tools that as salespeople we used to use professionally are just, they're becoming just dumpster fires, dude. I mean, it is just, I think people are looking, you know, where, and I can, you know, in trying to be empathetic to people's situation, right? I think people are going through, everybody's going through their own battle as it relates to this shift. And I think for a lot of people, there's been emotional baggage, right, that comes with it, whether you've been stuck at home with the kids or you're, you know, feel emotionally or, you know, deprived of interaction. So I think people are, you know, they resort to interesting things. But yeah, there's sometimes, there's not always a lot of forethought onto the things people communicate, right? It's a very emotional response. And it's kind of the same thing I teach my kids, right? You got to be careful because unlike saying something on a school bus, right? You put it up on social media, it's out there forever and for everybody to consume and judge, and it creates a whole other side effect. So I definitely think there's a lot of that going on. I mean, personally, dude, and you've probably noticed, I've removed myself from a lot of that stuff over the last few years, only because, quite honestly, it's a time thing too. I find they've figured out amazing models to just suck more time out of you. And quite honestly, when I'm online now, even more than I used to be, or I'm on Zoom, like 12 Zoom calls, the last thing I want to do when I'm trying to spend time with my kids or do something is, you know, be on my phone and checking it and stuff like that. So I've
so you're obviously not on TikTok.
So, you know, I try to consciously eject a lot of that stuff out of my life, for better or worse, right? I mean, I guess I don't suffer from FOMO, but, you know, I know for people that part, right, they feel like they're missing out. But, you know, I do feel like it creates groundswells, and so that's where it could be really, really dangerous, right? You see people kind of jumping on a bandwagon, and it kind of reminds me of, it's the equivalent of electronic trading, Rich, right? It's created overswings in the market that, like, humans can't normally respond to, right? It's no different than, like, we talk about these hedge funds and quant shops. To me, social media is the same thing for the emotional side of people's relationships. It creates these huge swings in dynamic, and for somebody looking for a cause, hey man, there's no better way to go get an audience, and you'll find somebody, you know. So I think you got to be careful these days, right? Become consuming, for better or worse, right? I think some people look at it as a way to help them through maybe what they're going through, right? You can find, you know, solidarity and commonality, but I think it has a lot of a negative effect on people too, right? They see I got 4 calls today on an IPO that just went off today, which I'm sure you know what's going on over there. And, you know, a lot of guys that have worked for me or had worked for me, you know, all kind of licking their wounds. Oh, I should have went there. Could have went. So, you know, there's this other effect that social media creates sometimes, which creates baggage. So.
Yeah, I'm always like, I mean, I don't know, when I bang my thumb with a hammer, I'll probably curse. Like, my first inclination is not to take a picture of it.
Right.
Type with my broken thumb. Like, my thumb is broken. I'm heading to the hospital. I really want to sit there. I need to have an episode. Just, I need a few of these people. Like, unfortunately, I don't know any of them. Like, I only see them on Facebook. But I really want to have an episode with them and says, why? Like, what's missing? How can I help you? All right. All right. Last question. So, this is for all 4 of you. So what are, like, cultural aspects or traits, of, like, organizationally do you guys value most? And we'll just go around the horn. We'll start with you. Start with you, Paige.
The most valuable traits. I would say, like, in a way, sameness and continuity, like, just, again, it comes back to, like, the feeling of belonging to a team, you know. It just, it's everything, because I just haven't really been a part of that for so long.
Did you say safeness or sameness?
Sameness.
Okay.
And also safeness. What?
Nothing.
And safeness, you know, just belonging somewhere, and just wanting, just sharing the same, you know, goals, aspirations. I mean, it's everything. You just being with a team that makes you want to do better. I mean, that's really all it takes in my mind. I mean, it's everything.
Could that be summed up as purpose? Like just feeling like you got a purpose?
Yes, this is why you're here, Rich, to translate what I'm saying. Yes, purpose.
All right, cool. How about you, Brooke?
Kind of along the same lines, I would say team building and working with a team that supports each other. And I don't know if this is really a trait, but with our culture, I feel like our team is really relaxed with each other, and nobody's, you know, you're not answering to a super stiff manager and you gotta, you know, straighten up when you talk. Like, I don't want to work like that. So having a supportive team that has a culture that jives with me, I guess, it's just fortunate that I have that, and it makes coming to work, so to speak, a lot more enjoyable.
And pushing each other to do, you know, like getting the PMPs and stuff. Like, we never would have done that. I mean, we would have, but coming to the team, you know, we're like, okay, let's all do this. And we all came together as a team to do it.
Yeah.
You guys know great cultures are made up of great people. The culture doesn't make the people. The people make the culture, right? So if every person who's on your team is a great person and a good person and someone you can trust, then the culture kind of takes care of itself. How about you, Dino?
So I kind of look at it, you know, as I look to build out teams and I compare teams I've worked on, and some of those, Rich, you probably know, different managers we worked over the years. I mean, it goes back to, you know, I think certain traits, right? I think what you guys bring up around support is key. I think, you know, people want to feel supported, right? But I think that comes, again, from finding a commonality. Now, I actually think you said kind of a common view. I actually have found teams, and I have always respected teams that can challenge my perspective. So I actually find teams that are most productive and my relationships are most productive when people can actually offer me a counter view to my own. And so I've always looked to build teams, and I've found the best performing teams are ones where ethically people align, but they challenge each other in terms of their skills or their strengths, right? And so you pair those people up, you pair those teams up, or you create teams of that, and they tend to be highly functioning. I think in there, though, you need to have core kind of, you know, commonality. You know, you need transparency, you need accountability, you need empathy, right? You need to feel like you're somebody who's or your team is empathetic, right? That they can understand and listen and appreciate that everybody's unique and has individual problems. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, you can probably go back to those, like, three or four core tenets, and I think you'd probably consistently find them across, you know, what people define as like great cultures. You know, they tend to find those traits repeatedly.
Yeah, I agree. I think you need to have diversity and people who speak up. But I also think having run the same team primarily for the last 13 plus years, when people feel supported, they contribute more, right? So you have people who maybe don't feel as comfortable early on, and they aren't contributing as much. It's usually because you can look at those people culturally and go, hey, this person's not a contributor or whatever, or you can take it upon yourself to say they're probably not comfortable, and eventually they'll feel supported and comfortable enough that they'll showcase their diversity and they'll change our culture for the better. And then I also think there's this idea of there's a fine line between listening and hearing what people have to say and making decisions, right? It's like, I always found that to be a fine line, because some people can feel supported just being heard, even if the decision doesn't land in their favor. And then they can rally behind the broader purpose, and other people, just in order to feel heard, it has to go their way. And I think culturally that can be a really tough thing to manage, right? Because I'm the kind of person, I want to hear everyone, but it doesn't always mean that like it's going to fall that way, right? Because sometimes it just can't. So I think that's like that's a tough, I would say for me, that's always the toughest thing to manage, that personality type where people don't feel heard if they don't get their way. And just because you're willing to listen and hear what everyone has to say, it doesn't mean it's going to be your way. And listen, I have the same thing. Like, people listen to me all day and never give me my way. And I have a lot to say. So I'm pretty used to being turned down. But that's it. Any parting words, DeVito?
No parting words. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the discussion. I love the idea behind the series. I think these topics are great, and I appreciate you guys accommodating the little schedule shift there. So thank you very much.
No problem. I appreciate you being here. How about you, Paige? Any parting words?
Yeah. I mean, thanks. I always can count on you to just have something come up, you know, that's just totally out of the ordinary. Like, I never do things like this before I came to your team. So, I mean, I can always count on you to do that. So thank you for having me.
My pleasure. How about you, Brooke?
Yeah. Fun talk. And where would we be without technology, you know? Yeah, just good stuff. I would agree with Paige. Thanks, Rich, for just doing things, bringing up games, bringing up topics, getting us closer as a team.
I bore easily. That's all it really is. I bore easily. All right, I appreciate you guys and gals for all being on. And that's it. Look for the publication, which I'll put out probably tomorrow. And it'll be on LinkedIn and Twitter and any other social media thing that our five viewers will surely enjoy this episode for. All right. Thanks, everyone. Have a great day or night.
Thanks. Right, bye.